Well, we're going to the dogs today. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Ever since I came to Alaska, I have been watching educated, qualified people give up careers to become dog mushers. What is the attraction? It cannot be the money. Our toll-free phone number, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call of 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. The relationship between people and dogs, people and wolves, too, is the subject on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce my guest today, who is Ted Carasotti. He is the author of Merle's Door, which is a bestseller about a dog. Ted, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
Now, I'm sure that we'll get some calls from people who are fans of Merle's Door, because it is the kind of book that has engendered a kind of a following or a fandom, I guess. And I was astounded when I went to your website and it said, Ted tries to answer every email. That's something.
Well, I'm usually about a month to 6 weeks behind, but I decided that if people were willing to write me, they deserved an answer from me, not my assistant. And so I've continued to try and answer them, but I fall ever farther and farther behind.
Yeah, well, we have the best of intentions, though.
I do have the best of intentions.
So you are basically, we're talking to you, you are sitting in your own built cabin there in Wyoming?
I am. I'm sitting here in my office looking out at the Teton Range, right on the edge of Grand Teton National Park in Kelly, Wyoming, a little village of 90 or 100 people, depending on the season. And it's where most of Merle's Door takes place. And the village is very much the way it was, 20 years ago, with a great place to be a dog since there's hardly any traffic, and it's surrounded by Grand Teton National Park on one side, the Gros Ventre Wilderness on the other, and National Elk Refuge on the third. So lots of room to roam, lots of wildlife, elk, bison, moose, deer, bighorn sheep, pronghorn antelope, wolves, grizzly bears, coyotes. And it's, if you like the outdoors and if you like to hunt, fish, ski, run rivers, it's a wonderful place to be.
Well, now, you said elk refuge, but I think that's kind of like wildlife refuge in Alaska, isn't it? I mean, that means you can go hunt the elk there, right?
Correct. Yes, you can hunt the elk on the National Wildlife Refuge.
And that's how I originally ran into you. You had written a book about elk hunting and getting your own meat and things like that, and it was really kind of a meditation on that. And
yeah.
You still managed to do that.
I do. We're eating the elk I shot this October with my new pup, Pucca, by my side up in the Gros Ventre, up in the wilderness there, on a snowy 0-degree October morning. And that's what we're eating. I still try to get a couple, three antelope each year. And this year, Pucca, who seems to love bird hunting, has really dragged me out to go grouse and pheasant hunting. So we've got a whole bunch of pheasants in the freezer as well this year. He loves to pheasant hunt.
So when did Merle's Door come out? When was the lifespan of Merle?
I met Merle on the San Juan River in Utah in April of 1991. I was going down there to run the San Juan with four friends from Jackson Hole, and we pulled into the campground at the put-in below Bluff, Utah at about 11:30 at night, and there was this big reddish golden dog, still young, still puppyish, in my headlights. And we opened up the doors to our two vehicles, and he came right up to my door, smelled my thigh, and looked up into my eyes with this look of luminous appreciation that said, "You need a dog, and I'm it." And it went on from there. He lay right down by my side when I put my sleeping bag under a cottonwood tree. We took him down the river. He swam between the kayaks, rode on the raft, and I brought him back here to Kelly. and gave him his own dog door so he could come and go as he wished and continue to lead the life in the outdoors that he seemed to love so much. I think he was a Navajo reservation dog that had been out on his own making his living eating ground squirrels and maybe killing the occasional calf until he met me. And he continued to come and go as he wished through his own dog door, was called the Mayor of Kelly, and became a really passionate elk hunter. He was with me when I shot elk year after year after year, and he loved to help me hunt elk by smelling them and pointing them out with his nose and giving me that look of, they're in there, buddy, let's go. So that was Merle, and when he passed away in June of 2004, I was brokenhearted and decided that one way to keep him close to me a little longer was to write his biography and talk about the many things he taught me about living with dogs that I had not known before being associated with Merle, even though I had had dogs before him. So the book came out in July of 2007 and became a bestseller within the first 3 weeks of its publication. It spent 9 months on the New York Times bestseller list, and it continues to sell well and has been published in 7 foreign language editions around the world. So that's the trajectory of Merle.
Well, you and it's also sort of done things for you. I mean, just the knowing of Merle certainly did a bunch of things for you, and we'll get to that. But also the having written this book, it sort of put you in. I mean, you were basically an outdoors columnist who would write the occasional book, and you became an author with this, you know, that basically has 2 more books coming out, right?
That is correct, and I made a decision before writing Merle's book. I had been in the freelance magazine business since 1979 as a kid, literally. I started writing as a teenager and started selling to Outdoor Life stories about fishing and hunting and then Sports Afield, Field and Stream, and built my career about writing about the outdoors, mostly hunting and fishing, but also quite a bit of skiing, wilderness paddling, rock climbing, mountaineering in the latter years of my magazine career. But by the early 2000s, the handwriting seemed to be on the wall in terms of the magazine industry no longer being as robust as the one I had started out in. The internet was stealing advertising from it. Magazines were becoming thinner. The word length for articles was becoming shorter, and I had to write more articles just to keep in place. Meanwhile, all of our expenses as writers were going up. So when I thought about writing another book, and at this point I had already published about 5 books, but you're quite correct in saying that I was a magazine writer who was feeding my addiction to write books by my salary from my magazines, I decided that in order to write Merle's Door, I really needed to go cold turkey from the magazine business. So I quit the magazine business, sold some property, paid off my debts, and paid off the mortgage on my house, and I took the proceeds and spent 11 months writing the proposal for Merle's Door. My agent then sold that for enough money for me to finish the book, and the great success of Merle's Door has enabled me now to make the transition from being a full-time magazine writer to a full-time book writer with 2 more books coming out in the next 2 years.
Okay, so a little bit of Merle's Door. From time to time, you look at the world through Merle's point of view as best you can gather it. You translate for Merle, as it were. Mm-hmm. I understand in one of your books now about your pup, Pucca, that's completely mm-hmm. in Pucca's point of view?
It's told in Pucca's voice, yes. It's called Pucca the Pup After Merle. It'll be out this October, and it has 200 full-color images of Pukka from the time he was born till the time he's about 6 months old, learning to become a dog in Wyoming. I took most of the images, but I also hired three photographers to follow Pukka and me around as we went on our first backpacking trips, our first climbing trips, ran the main fork of the Salmon, went out to the Pacific Ocean, and so they could document him and me together. And the captions for those photos are, again, my translation of what Pukka was telling me as he grew into young adolescence.
And then your other book is coming around the same time and going to be about more a veterinary angle?
The following book, which will be out in the fall of 2011, is called Why Dogs Die Young and What We Can Do About It. And it's a book that, as was the case in Merle's Door, mixes narrative and science. It's some Merle stories that didn't appear in Merle's Door. It's about my getting over his death, and it's about my meeting Pukka. And these vignettes, if you will, these anecdotes, describe and illustrate the science behind why dogs lead such short lives and how, by the decisions we make vis-a-vis where dogs live, how they live, the kind of care we give them, those things can either extend their lifespans or shorten them. The idea for this book actually came from the readers of Merle's Door, who wrote me and said, rhetorically, why do our dogs have to die so young, which is a question everyone who's loved a dog has asked. Why do dogs have to live 12 or 14 years, 15 years? But many of these readers also wrote to me and said, gosh, I know dogs have a short life, but why did my dog have to die at 1 year old, at 3 years old? Why did four of my five golden retrievers die of cancer? And I started to think, well, gosh, why do so many dogs die of cancer? Why do a lot of dogs die at an unconscionably young age? Like, the average age of a Bernese Mountain Dog is about 9 years. The average age of an Irish Wolfhound is about 6 years. Why is this? So I started doing some research, and Why Dogs Die Young talks about the five factors that I've identified that lead to dogs living short lives. One is inbreeding. One is the environmental pollutants that they're exposed to. Another is nutrition. A fourth is the way we over-vaccinate them. And the fifth is that probably spaying and neutering dogs at an early age contributes to shortening their lifespan as well.
Oh, boy. Well, you definitely got more talk shows than that one.
Yes, we do. And what's interesting is that the spaying and neutering has been used quite effectively to control stray dog populations and is now very politically correct in North America. However, if you look at Europe, the reverse is the case. About 90% of the dogs there, maybe more in some countries, maybe less in others, are left intact. And if you look at the data, golden retrievers, for example, live longer in Europe than they do in the United States. Why is this? And we've puzzled over this. And the answer may be that the sexual hormones that are contributed by ovaries and testicles are quite important for the proper growth of a young dog, and that they afford a kind of protection from chronic diseases like cancer that are taken away if we spay or neuter our dogs very early.
All right. We're speaking with Ted Carasotti. He's the author of the best-selling Merle's Door, and we're leading up to the Iditarod by going to the Dogs on Talk of Alaska. The telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Ted Carasotti, you decided not to have Merle put down. You decided to create a hospice for this dog. Do you feel that was the right thing to do?
Yes, I do. And all of us, in one form or another, are interpreters or translators of our dog's body language, their vocalizations, what they're telling us through their eyes. And we make decisions for our dogs based on the mutual language that we share with all dogs, but with our particular dog. And when Moreau became ill and started to decline, I never got the sense from him that he said, "Hey, Ted, I am suffering so much. I wish you would put me out of my misery." On the contrary, I would carry him out to his aspen tree and put him on the grass in that lovely June weather that we have here at times. And he would lie there and look at the mountains, look at the snow-covered Tetons, lie in the grass and look perfectly content and happy, even though he was no longer ambulatory. He was incontinent. And I figured, well, I'm very happy to take care of you as long as you look like you're not suffering and you're giving me that look of, you know, I just love looking at you. I could be here and with you sitting at my side forever if that's the way it turns out. So that's what I translated from Merle. He passed away naturally in my arms in early June 2004. And it was a decision I made for my dog. And what I've gotten from readers who have read Merle's Door, many, many people have said, you know, I wish I'd read your book before I put my dog down, because I think I put my dog down prematurely. And my experience with a lot of friends who have had dogs I've had in the past, is that we tend, I think, to put dogs down a little bit too quickly. Maybe that's because we don't like to see them. We project our pain onto them when, in fact, they may not be suffering. Or we don't have the time in our busy lives to take care of a dog every day. So am I saying what I did was right and that putting down a dog is wrong? No, I'm saying that each of us, when that awful moment comes, when we have to say goodbye to our dogs, has to make that decision from our heart and from the dog who's lying there, whom we know so well.
It seemed like you felt that you owed Merle something anyway, that you had learned a great deal from this dog.
I did. And in fact, that's the subject of Merle's Door and what the title speaks of metaphorically. The door was not only the physical door that I installed in my house so Merle could come and go. It was the door into the emotional and mental world of canines that Merle opened for me. And some of the most important things that he showed me, perhaps the most important, is that when we treat our dog like a peer, they become better problem solvers. They become a bit mellower. And they show us that they have a kind of capacity to learn and become self-actualized that they can never achieve if we're always their alphas telling them what to do. And it was a great corroboration for me after watching this happen between Merle and me to look pretty deeply into the literature of wolves and to watch a lot of wolves here after the reintroduction in 1995 that took place in Yellowstone National Park. And I had the opportunity to watch those wolves, to work with some of the biologists who led the project and who are still my friends. And what has been discovered is that the old notion of the alpha male wolf running the pack may be true for what happens in captivity, but in the wild, that's not the way wild wolves live. The alpha male and female tend to share leadership of the pack 50-50, and then when their pups become teenage wolves, if you will, a year old or so, their parents begin to delegate authority to them for making decisions about how the pack will be run, allowing them to choose whom to hunt, when to hunt, where to move the pack. They're out there in the lead hunting. And these young wolves will eventually become adults, go off and found packs of their own, and become alpha male and female breeding members of the pack. However, wolf society is a lot more like human society than any of us have imagined, in that we raise children to become functional, self-actualized adults. And subordination is really a passage of adolescence rather than a lifetime role. And I think this is very important to remember when we're living with our dog. And there have been some wonderful studies that have come out of Hungary that have showed that dog-human partners, in which the human is constantly the alpha, the dog is not as good a problem solver as in those partnerships in which the human allows the dog to make more of its own decisions.
Our guest is Kate Carasotti, author of Merle's Door. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at aprn.org, where Tom, good old Tom, has gotten in touch with us with his skeptical point of view. Always great to hear from Tom. He says, does he still let his dogs run loose, chase animals, attack other dogs? Oh, his doesn't do that much? Well, some is documented in the book. That's what every irresponsible dog owner says. All right. Grab onto that one, Ted Carasotti.
Well, did Merle chase cattle initially? Yeah, and we weaned him off that habit. Did he chase bighorn sheep on one or two occasions? Yes, he did. But he didn't chase bison, he didn't chase elk, he didn't chase the deer or moose that came around the house. And Pucca has been trained in the same way, to leave wildlife alone. As far as Merle attacking other dogs, Merle never attacked another dog. In fact, he himself was attacked by a German Shepherd on a leash, I may add. And that has been shown to be the case, that the most dangerous dogs, the dogs that tend to be the least well-behaved, are dogs who are constantly kept on leash, never get to meet dogs off-leash on their own terms. So Kelly, in a sense, is a dog paradise. That none of the dogs here are on leash. They can roam around. They don't chase wildlife. And I know that this is not the case for most of America, most of urban and suburban America, but even in the most urban place you can imagine, let's take New York City, for example, there are parks in New York City where you can take your dog and there are off-leash hours. Dogs can roam around and meet other dogs and play at dog speed. And I think that every community in the United States should have those kind of places where dogs can be dogs.
You realized at some point when you started letting Merle run free that there was, I don't know the word for it, but let's say devotion. The dog was devoted, but that didn't mean that you were the sum total of the dog's life.
That Merle, is correct.
That Merle had a bunch of other stuff that he was interested in. And from his point of view, from the way his senses work and so forth, it would have to be that way.
Yeah, and I think one of the great fallacies that we entertain is that a dog's love is totally unconditional. I simply don't believe that, and I've seen that from the dogs whom I've lived with. Merle could come and go as he wished, and sometimes he would be gone for 5 hours, and he'd come back and give me his pant. You should have seen what I saw. And after the book was published, I would receive letters from people who would say, you don't know me, but I met Merle once 2 miles down the Gros Ventre River. I was painting there on my easel, and this big golden reddish dog came up, sat down, said hello, very politely watched what I was doing for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then walked on. Or another person who said, oh, I met Merle up in Ditch Creek, and he led us around on the ski trails up there around the Teton Science School on a wonderful two-hour tour, and then brought us back to the school. And so Merle had this own life of his that was not mine, and I think it's very condescending of us to think that a dog looks at us like its son and has no other input in its life. And that could be true if the dog is kept inside and not allowed to meet other dogs and other people on its own time.
Yeah, but it's kind of suspect, isn't it?
Kind of suspect? What do you mean?
It's kind of suspect for us to be thinking that the dog is unconditionally devoted to us. It's sort of an easy way to think.
Oh, I think so. And it's wonderfully self-serving because what other relationship in the world do we have that is unconditional? There isn't. You know, our spouses have other interests. Our spouses disagree with us. Sometimes our spouses leave us. There isn't another relationship in the world, maybe a young child to its parent, but our children grow up and they leave us. And so isn't it comforting to think that our dogs will always be faithful and always unconditionally love us? I think Merle was faithful. As you say, he always came back. He liked coming back to the house. He liked me. But did that mean that I was his sole interest? Hardly.
Yeah. Ted Carasotti is our guest. He's the author of Merle's Door. We're talking dogs. Dogs are definitely descended from wolves, right? Every single one of them, even a Pekingese.
Every single one of them. That seems to be genetically proven a number of years ago that dogs are 99.6 or 7% genetically. Wolves can interbreed with wolves, and as a lot of us have noticed, have a lot of wolfish behavior, you bet.
And there is some dispute, but I'm pretty well convinced by the research that you lay out in your book that there's been a relationship between wolf and human that goes back to the point where there's a co-evolution process that went on between both species. In other words, humans without wolves would have come out different, and dogs without humans would have come out different.
Yeah, and there is controversy in the scientific world as to how wolves became dogs. And the two tenets of thought are that, one, wolves did not become dogs until somewhat late in our history when we started to settle in villages and became herders and farmers. And wolves, or a certain segment of wolves, decided to eat at our refuse piles, became more conditioned to people, and over time became less wolf-like, had smaller brains, smaller teeth, and became more adapted to eating our garbage. The other theory says that actually humans and wolves struck up a deal, a partnership, began to co-evolve a lot earlier in our history, maybe 40,000 years ago, maybe even earlier than that, and that certain wolves followed human hunters around to scavenge on their carcasses, and likewise, we scavenged on wolf carcasses, because when you're out there and there's no grocery store, everything's about energy conservation, especially before the time of fossil fuels. And so if you could find an elk or a caribou carcass that a wolf pack had brought down and hadn't completely eaten, you'd go over there and chase them off of it and use it. And likewise, wolves would take the leavings of the human-killed wildlife carcasses. As that was happening, certain wolves developed a less of a flight reaction to the humans, kept closer to them. Maybe humans started stealing wolf puppies from their dens, because if you were a young teenager without TV and a computer and video games, what could be more fun than having a nice little wolf puppy to play with? And the more tractable of those wolf pups eventually became the wolves that people bred with each other, and quickly, relatively speaking, became domestic dogs.
Yeah. Ted Carasotti's our guest. It's Talk of Alaska, and he'll be back when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, unlocking Alaska's resource potential. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
It's Talk of Alaska. Our guest, the author of Merle's Door, Ted Carasotti, by telephone from Wyoming. Ted, we've been talking about the dog mushers here, sort of an obsession this time of year around Alaska, the working dogs. And I have, it seems that every year there's another discovery of untapped physical potentials in these dogs. Most recently at the Yukon Quest, where they discovered they could shorten the rest, and the dog could bounce back in a couple of hours. I imagine this doesn't surprise you that much.
No, I think we increasingly will find out more and more about canine physiology that surprises us, and we will also find different ways to apply what we learn from dogs to human medicine and human longevity. A great example of this is that the original limb-sparing surgery for osteosarcoma was done at Colorado State University, where they, instead of amputating a limb, they were able to take out the cancer and put in metal rods to replace the cancer in a dog's leg bones. And the dog healed up and went on to live a normal lifespan. That same kind of surgery is now used in teenagers, human teenagers, that have osteosarcoma, a disease that, by the way, is virtually identical in dogs and young teenagers. So there's an example of how dog research helped us.
Yeah, well, yeah, Mike Davis has actually been exploring that. He was our guest a couple of years ago on Talk of Alaska on our Iditarod show. He's the guy that said, I guess you can give the dog mushers some tips because you're a vet, so you figure out how they can get more out of their dogs. He says, no, I'm in total awe of these dogs. They're doing things that every law of physiology says they shouldn't be able to. I'm just trying to figure it out. But he's now got a DARPA grant, and that's what he's looking at, is human peak performance.
Mm-hmm. One thing I learned from my dogs when they were really physically active is that they just fall asleep when they're done, right away, just boom, as we've all seen. And they'll nap for 20 minutes or an hour, and as you say, they bounce right back up and are ready to go. And I started thinking, well, maybe this would be a good thing for me to do when I had a big day in the mountains or a big day on my bicycle. So what I've started to do is midday on, say, a 100-mile bike ride or a 20-mile hike is just lay down and nap for 20 minutes to a half an hour, and I have found that it's been amazingly helpful in restoring my energy. And I don't know what the physiological process is there, and I'd love to find out, but it certainly does seem to cross the species line, and that a little nap like that in the midst of a big day helps both dogs and humans.
Yeah, I think it had something to do with hormones, as I recall, but I don't know. I'll put it in an email to you. You can read it in a couple of months there, Ted.
Okay.
let's go to the phones. Ralph joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ralph, with Ted Carasotti.
Hi, Steve. This is Ralph Tingey, and I wanted to let Ted know that his friend Amy McCarthy gave me that book while I was house-sitting there for them, and I really enjoyed it.
Not a book. Oh, thanks so much, Ralph. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah.
He's a good friend. I
lived in Kelly in the 70s on the little
wow.
little ranger station on the corner there, so I always felt like home to me. So when I heard you on the radio today, I was really delighted.
Well, I can go out to the window here on the other side of my office and just about see that little ranger station that's still there.
Yeah, anyway, the only thing I would comment is that I always thought that dogs love to eat. And when you talked about eating a few minutes ago, I thought, oh, yeah, that's the real motivator for dogs, and maybe that was why they eventually ended up bonding with humans. So
I think you're absolutely right. Almost every dog I've ever met loves to eat. There are a few who are not food-motivated, and those are the ones that are harder to train, I think.
Years ago, I raced sled dogs in the 80s, and I remember I asked Joe Reddington one day, who was the father of the Iditarod, I said, Joe, I've got this dog, Chief, that I bought from a guy, and Chief wouldn't eat very well. And he said, well, don't feed him. And so I went out to the dog yard and fed all the dogs, and then when they were all through eating, Chief hadn't touched his food, so I took it away and gave it to the dog next to him. That happened 3 days in a row. On the third day, he ate like a champ, and he never again missed a meal.
Very clever of you.
Yeah. No, it's clever of Joe, not of me. Yeah. Anyway, just thought I'd say hi, and very nice to make your acquaintance. The next time I'm in Kelly, I'll look you up.
Please stop by. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
okay.
Ralph, great to hear from you.
Yeah, good to hear from you, Steve. Thanks.
Yeah, Ralph was a ranger in that ranger cabin, by the way. Well, yeah, you mentioned at one point that your mother, who is Greek Orthodox, is trying to console you about the impending death of your dog, Merle. And by her belief system, the dogs don't have souls. But she almost goes over the line on this one here.
she does, and let's see. I can actually find that place in the book. She had blessed Merle's photo on her refrigerator with the thymiata. That's the censer with which devout Greek Orthodox direct incense toward the people they wish to protect, and her gesture really touched me, because though what she had done was in heresy, it did go beyond the canons of the church with respect to animals, since they don't believe animals have souls. And my mom, after a few minutes later, when she was talking on the phone with me, she said, Merle is such a good dog, who knows where his... And she stopped herself short, unable to use the soul word for him. Who knows where Merle might end up, she said. And I think she certainly herself believed that Merle had a soul, but was unable to articulate it because it went against her church teachings.
You don't have the slightest shadow of a doubt that there's somebody home behind those eyes.
I don't. Not one iota of a doubt that there's someone home behind those eyes. And in virtually every dog I've met, there's always someone home. And it's always been very sad for me to think that our great religious traditions, some of our great religious traditions, have not given animals, especially dogs, the same kind of soul value that humans have, because as I'm sure thousands of people who are listening right now would and live with dogs would say, sure, my dog has a soul.
Yeah, but I don't, on the other hand, get the sense that you really have much opposition to the idea of working dogs, you know, the dogs that do the trap line or pull races around.
No, I don't, not in the least. And in fact, I had a wonderful experience when I was researching one of my books, Blood Ties. I spent January in the Brooks Range, up 120 miles north of Fort Yukon, with a family who was running a trap line. And they gave me four big Malamutes to run on the trap line on a dog sled, and it was my very quick indoctrination into what dog mushing was all about. And so, no, I feel like dogs, especially over the millennia, have been bred and selected for certain traits. And they love to do what they do. My dog Pucka these days seems to love bird hunting the way Merle never did, and that's who Pucka is. So we go bird hunting, and if dogs love to pull sleds and take such joy in it, who are we to say that they shouldn't do that?
And it is joy. I mean, I think that's one thing that you sort of nailed down fairly well in your science, that you researched for your book, Merle's Door, is that emotion is a central part of the being of a dog.
Mm-hmm.
You can't talk about dogs without talking about emotion.
No, and when I watch wild wolves hunting or playing here in right around the house, literally. I'll give you one example of emotion in wolves. I was driving home the other day and from Jackson, which is about 16 miles down the valley, and you turn off the main highway that goes through Jackson Hole. It's a two-lane road, and you get on a smaller road that goes up the Grovant River for about 7 miles, and there is a lateral moraine that comes off a place called Blacktail Butte, and it's probably maybe 50, 60 feet high, and it looks over the river plain, and up there was this big gray wolf lying on his belly, ears pricked, and he's looking down at four bull elk lying maybe 300 yards from him in the snow. And he just was gazing around, and every once in a while he'd look back at these elk, and he'd get that smile on his face that dogs get. And this wolf just looked like, you know, this is the best place in the world to be, and I am as happy as I possibly can be. And I think wolves often express that great happiness in their hunting, in their families, in their play. And dogs have inherited all of those emotions that we can all see. And if we had to pick one, I think, that really epitomizes what dogs are all about, it's happiness and joy. Most of the time, if dogs get to play and run, they seem to be about the happiest beings on earth.
All right. We're talking with Ted Carasote, the author of Merle's Door. And Artie joins the program from Ketchikan. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Artie.
Hi, thank you. Hi, Ted.
Hi, Artie. How are you?
Thank you for doing this interview. This was great. I read your book, and I thoroughly enjoyed your book. It was a well-written book, and you did such a good job about describing Merle and his life and his adventures, and I love it when I read a book and I feel like I'm there. And so I wanted to just tell you, I thought it was an excellent book. And
thank you.
I'm really excited that you're writing another one about Pucka.
Thank you very much.
I did want to just say that one of the things that really struck me about your book is that you often address the relationship between yourself and Merle, and you talk about how you interact and how you come to an understanding about what he would like, what you would like, and how you work together. And I commend you on that. I think that's wonderful. I really do sadly see a lot of people that their dog is just kind of an item. We have a car, we have a boat, and we have a dog. And mm-hmm. I work with dogs, and I have a pet sitting business and a dog walking business, and I really try to work with people and explain to them that there's so much more to a dog than it just being an item. And I thought you did a really good job addressing that in the book. So thank you for that.
You're very, very welcome. It's one of the things that grieves me about the relationship between humans and dogs, and that is, if you're a human and you decide to get a dog and bring it into your life, you have to remember that this is another thinking, feeling being. It's not a boat. It's not an ATV. It's not a car. You can't just park it in the garage for weeks at a time and then take it out and play with it. And we can see this often when people are walking their dogs in morning, especially in urban places, and they've got a cup of coffee, they've got their cell phone glued to their ear, and they're dragging their dog along on a leash, and the dog just wants to be reading the newspapers of its world, smelling, and it's getting dragged along. Well, obviously that's a relationship which is very human-centered. The person's not paying that much attention to the dog. And one really has to question, in those kind of human-dog relationships, if the human would be better off giving their dog to someone who was going to invest more time in it. And I think you probably see this a lot in your business, in which there are a whole bunch of folks that never really stop to consider exactly how much time and commitment living with a dog takes.
Yeah.
I agree with you. It's like having a child. It really is mm-hmm. like having a child. The responsibility, absolutely. And I know you probably have more calls, but I just had to tell you one little funny thing. I shared your book with my mom, and she's in her mid-70s, and she lives down in Georgia now. And she absolutely loves your book, and you've become almost godlike. frequently says now, well, Ted said that.
Well, if Ted said it, he probably learned it from Merle.
Absolutely. Well, I thank you for sharing Merle with us, and I am really looking forward to reading about Pucca and also this other book where you're going to, did I hear correctly that you're going to address over-vaccinating and spaying and neutering too young?
That is correct.
I'm really looking forward to that, too. Though I will say I do support people spaying and neutering their animals because I see far too many animals that are put down, especially in our community, because people allow them to run and they end up pregnant.
Yeah. Let me mention, as long as you've brought that up, that I have spent quite a few weeks in Europe now going around to animal shelters, talking to veterinarians and geneticists, just trying to piece out how a very developed society like Europe can leave 90% of their dogs intact and not have the stray dog problem that we do. The answer is that people there seem to be more considerate of others in controlling their dogs. The other thing I want to bring up is that there are other ways to prevent unwanted canine pregnancies besides spaying and neutering, and these are vasectomies, tubal ligations, and ovary-sparing hysterectomies. We have defaulted to the easiest way of not allowing dogs to be parents, and that is to take out their gonads. But there are other ways. There are veterinarians that give dogs vasectomies or tie their tubes. And I think that 50 years from now, 60 years from now, we will see more dogs getting those kind of birth control measures than being spayed and neutered, just because we're finding out very rapidly how much healthier it is to retain your sexual hormones as a dog and as a person, if you might add.
That's interesting. You know, I didn't know that. That's really interesting. And now I'm going to go research that. Thank you.
All right, Artie, thank you so much for your call from Ketchikan. It's Talk of Alaska. Ted Carasotti is our guest, author of Merle's Door, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
It's Ted Carasotti on Talk of Alaska. We're talking about dogs, and you may be able to help Larry here, who remembers a book he read as a young boy. Maybe you will know about this one, Letters to Strongheart. Strongheart was a dog who, after his death, his owner wrote a series of letters which were compiled into this book. It affected me greatly. I can no longer remember the content of the book, but I wish I could reread it. Thanks for the opportunity to hear of your experiences, Larry. Do you ever hear of that book?
I have heard of that book, and I believe that you can buy it at Amazon. I remember it, and it's, gosh, let me, it's by John Allen Boone, who wrote a book called Kinship with All Life, which I have right on my shelf.
Whoa.
There it is. I just walked over there and saw it. And yes, he did write Letters to Strongheart, and I just Googled Amazon, and you can buy it at Amazon.
All right. Let's go to Bruno, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bruno.
Good morning. Good morning. I've enjoyed your discussion here this morning, and in some of your talk about the domestication of dogs from wolves, sort of prompted me and reminded me of this article that I thought I'd add to this table here, and it was about a scientist named Dmitry, I think it's Belyev, he was back in the days of Stalin. He spent many years breeding a silver fox, and I think he
Correct.
Was in Siberia or something. But what he did was he took these wild silver fox and selected only the fox that showed up with the least fear of humans.
Right.
And eventually, I'm sorry?
Yeah, that's a well-documented phenomenon.
It was fascinating to me because basically they selected the ones that showed the most positive response to humans, and what he ended up with was a population of foxes whose behavior and appearance was, like, drastically changed. And it was only about 10 generations of controlled breeding that they no longer showed any fear of humans, and then they often wagged their tails, they licked their humans to show affection, and they started having spotted coats and floppy ears and curled tails and lighter bone densities and this and that. And what they, to follow up with that, the adrenaline levels and other stress hormone levels changed drastically than their wild counterparts. And in a sense, one of the hypotheses of at least the person who presented this article that I had read was that the domestication of these canines is that they're actually kind of being bred to remain in a puppy-like kind of, sense of being or genetically speaking anyway. So, and I just thought, well, that was quite interesting, and it kind of had a lot to do with, I thought, what you're saying with the domestication of wolves.
Powerful argument. Yeah, Ted, you go into a lot of the same areas in your book.
Yeah, and in fact, I cover Dmitry Belyev's work with the silver foxes and talk about exactly as the caller in just mentioned, that within a short number of generations, he had bred foxes that were quite tractable, really enjoyed being around people. And I use that as an example of how ancient hunters could quickly have chosen some tractable young wolf puppies, bred them, and after not all that long of a time, produced what we now, well, the ancestors of the domestic dog.
All right, Bruno, thank you so much for your call from Fairbanks. Ted Carasotti's our guest. Yeah, Ted Carasotti's our guest on Talk of Alaska. And Raymond joins the program from Heidelberg. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Raymond.
Thank you, Steve. I would like to ask your guest, Ted, if he's ever studied much on a dog's sixth sense to sense danger, like a house when it's on fire, that alerts people that they're usually living with and saving their lives, or a kid falling in the water and alerting somebody that will save them, or, you know, something like that. And it just seems, I've always been curious about why a dog seems to have a sixth sense of danger.
Mm-hmm. It may not be a sixth sense, but it may be that the senses that they have, some of them are so much more acute than ours. Their sense of smell, for example, is thousands of times better than ours. And their sense of hearing, especially to high-frequency sounds, is much better than ours. And so if a dog may smell smoke way before we have, or hear an intruder way before we will, I think one of the most interesting uses of dogs lately has been their ability to scent cancer, and scent it in a way that seems incomprehensible to us, but they're able to smell melanomas, they're able to smell breast cancers, and they paw at them, they lick at them, and people way before they would have noticed it themselves go and have it examined, and sure enough, the dog has saved another person's life.
So you don't necessarily need to call in the supernatural if they have so much better senses than we do in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
Would it have anything to do with the more attachment they have, like to say one of your kids say your house is on fire and you have three kids in the house?
Oh, I think that Raymond.
Be more apt to try to save one of them or all of them?
Well, I think Raymond, there's no doubt that they're very emotion driven.
I understand that.
We don't have too much time here.
Yeah. Well, you answered my question. Thank you for taking the call. And,
right. Yeah, Ted.
Enjoying your program.
Ted.
You're welcome, Raymond.
Do you have something more to add to that?
No, I think you're quite right in saying you don't have to invoke the supernatural. There are a lot of very good physiological reasons why dogs can scent things before we can.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
You're very, very welcome, Steve. Thank you for having me on your show once again.
Got a note from Richard Feinberg. He said he really appreciated the fact that you got a hold of him because you wanted to get to the original researcher of some of his research. He said he didn't know if you'd remember or not. But
thank you. Thanks very much.
Wanted to pass that on. And we'll be looking forward to your forthcoming books about dogs. It's Talk of Alaska. Dave Waldron on the controls, and Pat Yak and Lynn Anderson on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.